Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Welcome back to Get Off My World. I'm Pat.
And I'm Joshua.
And I'm Kelvin.
And today we're joined by Melissa Kircher.
Hello.
And Wendy Bowlesby.
Hi there.
These are the ladies from Xanadu Cinema Pleasure Dome.
Yes.
Our sister podcast, can we call it that?
Oh, sure.
Well, thank you, ladies, for coming out on this rainy and windy Minneapolis night to talk about Doctor Who.
Thank you, thank you. Yay.
As you know, we like to start each episode with a round we call Temporal Grace, which is where we go around and we say something that we love about Doctor Who. Joshua, why don't you start today?
I was at Steel Toe Brewery here in St. Louis Park just a couple days ago prepping. And by prepping, I mean I was just watching Doctor Who on my phone while drinking beer. And in walks a young lady in a TARDIS dress. Now, if you've been to a convention, you've seen these all around, these TARDIS dresses. And so my first reaction is what we've heard a lot of older fans say a lot of late about, like, it's so strange to see young people who are super into this thing that no one was into when we were young. But that wasn't what was interesting, because she walked in and you could hear this sort of murmur throughout this bar of, like, ooh, TARDIS, Doctor Who, dress, did you see? Girl. You know. And it went all the way around. I'm like, okay, so everybody is cued into this now, but that's not even what was truly fascinating about this experience, because then sitting next to me was a guy in his 20s, maybe early 30s, with someone who was clearly his dad, a guy in his 50s, sort of big pot-bellied guy with a mustache, kind of looked like the old Chicago Bears sketch from Saturday Night Live, one of those guys. And he leaned over and started to explain the TARDIS to his dad, right? And his dad was like, I know what a TARDIS is. And his son was really shocked that his dad knew. And in that moment, I realized that we had come completely full circle. Now that the new series is 10 years old, we now have people in their 20s who grew up watching the new series and are shocked by old people who know what Doctor Who is.
That's fantastic.
It was amazing.
Oh, and I have one.
Well, there is a relatively new website in town called Twin Cities Geek, and various friends of mine are blogging for it, including Wendy over here.
Yeah, although I'm stepping away because I won't be a Twin Cities Geek much longer.
Yeah, you're going to be a Texan Geek pretty soon. But what my pick is that my lovely young cousin, who is college age, her name is Mariah Kircher, and she is like the only other geek in my actual close family. She started writing for it, and her inaugural post was about fitness and Doctor Who, like using Doctor Who to exercise.
is she gonna
we'll wait to that, because I need to read it.
I kind of want to know how Doctor Who inspires movement. Like, do you exercise like a Dalek, or
there's a lot of
walk like a siren? Yeah.
There's a lot of running away from
or
things.
Duck walking, right?
Yeah,
I think a lot of it more has to do using the length of various Doctor Who episodes to gauge your fitness.
Oh,
but it is a very long article, so it's more detailed than that.
Fun,
excellent.
Yes,
I was rather amused to see this got passed around a lot on social media. The trailer for the new LEGO Dimensions game that's coming out, which is a team-up between the 12th Doctor, Batman, Gandalf, and a character I don't know called Wildstar.
Oh, boy.
And Peter Capaldi is actually doing the voice of the Doctor. And I'm so amazed by this just because it's exactly the sort of wacko multiverse kind of story I would probably come up with as a kid with just the random toys I had laying around.
I can imagine young Kelvin drawing in crayons, drawing Batman and Doctor Who. And
I saw the trailer. It looks pretty awesome. There's a point at which he seems to reverse regenerate into all the other Lego incarnations of the Doctor too. So
nice.
Oh, I want to see that.
And I just was amazed, like, you know, we live in a time where the current Doctor can be in a Lego game that's a big release. Like,
the world's gone mad.
Yeah, the world has lost its mind.
All right, so I don't know if you guys know about this, but David Tennant and, oh, I'm blanking on her name now, Donna.
Oh, Catherine Tate.
Thank you. They were in a production of Much Ado About Nothing where they played Beatrice and Benedict.
Oh, no.
Together.
Wow.
Oh, no.
And this, it actually got the thing where they show it in theaters, and it's kind of hard to find. I haven't successfully found it yet, so I haven't actually gotten to watch it. But the reason I bring that up is this literally would not exist without Doctor Who and the two of them not just meeting each other, but the whole public learning to love them as a pair, as a couple, and how well they spar together. And I'm just so excited that my nerdery of Doctor Who is now crossed over to Shakespeare. Yay! That's what I got.
So last weekend, my wife and I were at the wedding of two friends of ours, one of whom is the unaffiliated critic, friend of the Get Off My World podcast. This was one of the best weddings we've ever been to. It was beautiful, it was heartfelt, it was in a wonderful space, beautiful wedding dress, great food, lots of joy and tears and stuff, but none of that is important whatsoever. Because on the suit that Michael, the unaffiliated critic, was wearing, he was also wearing a Doctor Who tie pin and cufflinks. It was the Gallifreyan design from the new series that you see on, like, the watch in Human Nature, the circles, the intersecting circles that look a little like watch gears. It was very beautiful and subtle and understated, and nobody would have noticed, including myself, if he had not pointed it out to me.
Tasteful nerdery. That's
what we like on this podcast.
And now round two, special topics, Dalek. And today our topic is going to be given to us by Wendy and Melissa.
Okay.
The topic is women in Who, right?
Yes, ladies. It's a ladies' night. We should talk about the ladies.
Let us talk
two
about the ladies in Who.
Favorite W's. Women in Who.
Well, there are women in Doctor Who.
There are.
A couple
there
here
are
and there.
Women, yeah. And it's fascinating to use women as sort of a touch point of culturally how things have shifted over the years, but also sort of what our expectations are from the Doctor. I mean, even if you just lock into the new Who, the change from Rose through Donna to Amy Pond and River and Clara, I mean, it's really interesting the way their relationships shift with the Doctor. And then, of course, you go all the way back to, like, Sarah Jane and Romana, and that's what I got right now.
Teela and Tegan and...
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Ace.
Oh, Ace, yeah.
I'm Don't, like, forget Ace.
Don't forget Ace. Don't forget
Ace. Ace is awesome.
So a lot of what I felt, and we can talk about this, about women in the new Doctor Who, is that they seem to be conscious alternatives to the women who came before. Mm-hmm. So you have Rose that set the template for the romantic companion for the new series, but then you had Martha, who was someone who had unrequited love for the Doctor because he was still hung up on Rose. And then where do you go from there? You have to go further than that because that's just a closed universe. You need to do something other. And then so Donna was the first companion that at least I see as having started to break away from that.
It's interesting to me that the lineup of female companions in the new series, because I see a lot of things happening there that are happening with roles of women in media in the larger sense, because over the last decade and a half or so, as it's been stated online, the Trinity Syndrome has been happening. You know, like, we need more strong women in movies, in TV shows, and a lot of it has just translated into women who happen to be able to punch things.
Right.
And there's a certain sameness in that, and not actual characters being formed. And there's something like that happening in a lot of the new Who female companions, I think, which, it, you know, as Pat had mentioned about there's this unrequited love, or a lot of it's formed as a love story, and Donna seems to be the only one that is really isolated from that. She is a fully realized character. She doesn't need to be romantically in love with Doctor Who, but the two of them definitely have a chemistry together. They're like brother and sister, or like he's her gay male best friend. They're
sassy, you know, best friend.
Yeah, the sassy best friend. And so there's a chemistry there, but it's not romantic. It's really refreshing.
Well, I was frustrated by Rose and Martha being romantic towards the Doctor, because that's not the Doctor who I grew up with, and that's not what I want from the Doctor. I don't want him to be a romantic interest. I want him to be an adventurer.
Yeah, and you even get that with Amy Pond, and you get that definitely with River Song, and
exactly.
And it continues after Donna too, which I find very frustrating. It's like you had
very
great,
frustrating.
Great concept in Donna,
and then you have. And you also have Rose, who's young and pretty, and just, oh, look, your typical female companion. And what I love about Donna is she's older. Mm-hmm. She's not pretty in any traditional sense. But she's smart and capable and able to talk back to the Doctor. And she demonstrates that there's, you know, as a lot, actually, when you go back even, like, to Sarah Jane, because rewatching Pyramids of Mars, I'm like, that's right, there were... companions always had, well, generally the best ones, were capable. And that's what made them their best episodes. They were equal partners with the Doctor. And so, but Donna's my favorite of the new companions, simply because every time they're like, oh, are you two together? She's, no. No, that's not what I need. I don't need a man to define me. I'm here for the adventure. Mm-hmm. That is a great female character.
And also, Donna had this amazing arc. You know, you start with Runaway Bride... That was the name of the episode, right?
Yeah.
Where
yeah.
she is annoying.
It took me a long time to warm to Donna because the Runaway Bride bothered me so much. Mm-hmm. Not exactly a positive portrayal of womanhood.
She was a little lampoonish, but she was written as a real character. You know, a lot of times you see characters, not just women in Doctor Who, where, you know, they're presented right away as some sort of exceptional, and she just wasn't.
She was just a temp.
Yeah.
She was a temp secretary.
Yeah.
I think that... if I were English and I had grown up watching the Catherine Tate show and I knew more about Catherine Tate's career, this would conform a little bit more to that. But as my first reaction was very similar to Kelvin's, but I think it's probably of a piece with what she was doing on her own show and in British pop culture at the time. And so maybe that's what allowed her the space to kind of break from the template of the Doctor Who companions at that point, because she already had a pre-established popular culture persona, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah.
I guess Billie Piper did too, but that was a conscious reaction against that. She was a pop singer.
Yeah, she was like the Britney Spears of England at one point.
Although, to give Rose some credit, for as much as I don't like the romantic template of companions, she was the first one really to do that, and also... She did have a really well-realized character for, you know, she was just ordinary kid swept up into the TARDIS, and she came into her own later, and I really liked
that she really did present that ordinariness, like, oh my god, I'm totally here, this is so cool! And the Torchwood episode where they were trying to get the Queen to say we are not amused. it's the little things that make me giggle. But what I really love to bridge the two is when Sarah Jane showed up in the new series.
Oh, yeah.
And what that brought into the discussion of the characters. Is that the first time we've revisited a companion later?
The first time in that way.
It depends on how you define revisit, I guess.
They go see the Brigadier again in Modron Undead and then in Battlefield in the original series.
But yeah. I feel like this is the first time that somebody told the Doctor, do you know what it was like to get left behind?
Mm-hmm. In the televised series, that is true.
And I love that they brought that up, because it really was sort of the first time that somebody, that we sort of confronted the idea that, traveling with the Doctor is great. How is the rest of your life going to go?
Mm-hmm. I think
I felt that kind of undermined. I mean, there's a whole camp of these people. I'm one of them out there. But I felt it really undermined Sarah's character and does not line up at all with the last episode from the classic series. I felt that was sort of heightening the drama and sort of made her this empty person. like the doctor left and she's just been pining for him forever. Well, and she doesn't find a new life to live until she meets him again, and then she gets a spinoff.
So it's
she
like
has
she
satisfaction.
Was, so she was like shoved into this mold that
of the for new series
mold. Of the new series mold of
is
the women
the doctor
pining
provides
after the doctor.
Your entire life.
See,
and when he goes away, you either have to get trapped in an alternate universe, or like Donna, you have to go back to being a shallow caricature because you're back
okay,
on Earth.
And that's a
it,
fair
it had
criticism
a sadness to me that I didn't really enjoy. As much as the geek in me loved to see Sarah Jane again and loved to see K-9 and loved to see some emotion there, but I thought that was a stretch, I think, to push her into the new series mold.
I have two reactions to that. One, that's true, and I have a lot of problems with the way women are portrayed in the new series and some of what, it's Moffat, right?
So Moffat's a new,
yeah.
new showrunner. Yes.
Yeah, and Moffat, yeah. Moffat has some real, he's said some things that make it clear that he's got some perspectives on women that are perhaps problematic. But yeah. my other point of view is, I don't see it so much as pining, I didn't read it for me as pining for the doctor as much as the very real truth of, you were traveling the universe and no matter how much you thought at the time that you were ready to go back to your life, there's going to be a part of you that always misses the crazy things you used to be able to do. I mean, that's part of getting older. You like your life now. I love my life now. But I do miss that I can't just pack up and drive for 30 hours in any direction.
I think that that's psychologically true. Mm-hmm. I think... Maybe not to speak for Joshua, but for myself, what I reacted to, I'll just, what Josh means to say.
Could you mansplain for Josh?
I will. It's not that that's an unworthy topic to discuss. In fact, it's a fascinating topic to discuss.
Oh,
what sort of
yeah.
lives does the doctor leave behind? But that it seemed to have been shunted into a very narrow kind of template on the show. And Mickey hits it right on the head. He says that it's about the new girlfriend and the ex,
mm-hmm.
right? He says that straight up to the doctor, and that's really what the show is like. It's like the kind of wacky getting to know one another, resenting one another, coming to like one another of romantic comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, does cheapen the depth of the relationship.
I hear what you're saying, and I agree with it, but it didn't bother me quite as much.
Sure. Well, you guys were talking about problematic stuff with Moffat's tenure on the show. Could
oh
you
boy.
Elaborate with that for our listening audience?
It's really sad because I was very much looking forward to Moffat's tenure on the show because I really liked his one-off episodes when they were popping up. It's like, these are brilliant! And I, you know, I fell in love with Blank and all that. And then his female characters are... Wow.
Yeah,
do you have better formed
Claire.
Thoughts about this, Wendy? You may
well,
have more words.
Help me out. What are his female characters? Let's list them to start
so
with.
Amy. River Pond.
River Song.
Sorry. She's a pond.
Pond Scum.
Oh. Amy, River.
Clara Oswald.
And Clara. Yeah.
Those are the main ones.
My issue is they're strong, they're capable, they are definitely equal partners with the doctor, they're capable of taking him down a peg, but they're so... Not Amy, I actually take Amy out of this, because Amy's got a modifier, and that's Rory.
Yeah.
And that changes Amy's character a lot. But it's like he thinks that for a woman to be strong, she's going to be really bossy. It just bothers me.
Part of it is this weird trap we're in right now, where if it's a female character, we have to make them equal to the doctor. And if you go all the way back to the beginning of the series, men, women, they are companions, they are humans, and the humans don't know what's going on, and the doctor is this brilliant, crazy, superior alien. And so he's always got one up on them, whether they be, you know, male or female. And occasionally we do have these really well-rounded characters with Sarah Jane, even
Ace.
Leela, Ace, but they're not the doctor's equal. And Moffat seems obsessed with his companions of making them the doctor, like doctor number two.
Like the Dr. Donna.
Yeah, Dr. Mm-hmm. Well, or even
River
with
Song.
Clara and River Song and
Woman.
Even Amy to a certain extent. And it almost seems to me like if they would just let the female character just be a well-rounded character and not make them have to be the doctor's equal and have the keep the doctor in place and in line and all these things that seem to come in with the new series.
Starting with River, none of them is just human. The companions are all exceptional, and I do think you have a point there of we've gotten away from. I kind of get that maybe they're trying to, I mean, you have a male doctor, superior alien, and if the female, if the companion is female and subordinate, that gets a little
icky. All the males in the new series are beta males other than Captain Jack.
True.
Yeah. Well, but my point that I was leading to is the clear answer is that we have a female doctor. Yeah.
Moffat cannot do the female doctor. That I think that would be a disaster.
That could be
based on the writing of Missy in two episodes.
Like,
but
Elsa in space, only worse.
So, taking the strands of what we talked about, I'm gonna make a postulate, and we can agree or disagree with it.
Okay.
Or whatever. I would
postulate
say,
it.
I'm postulating that the new series, for all of its more progressive attitude generally, actually has more limited roles for women than the companions in the original series. I'm thinking of the original TARDIS crew, which is the Doctor, Ian, Barbara, and Susan. Mm-hmm. Let's leave Susan aside for the time being. But what we had there was a family unit with an elderly grandfather who was kind of incapable of taking care of himself. We had Ian, who would do all the punching, and Barbara, who was a recognizable motherly type without being pigeonholed as she wasn't a mother, but she filled the kind of role in the family and was able to take charge and do things that Ian was incapable of doing. And throughout most of the classic series, there were plenty of opportunities for women to have, well, Sarah Jane is a journalist, Joe is flighty but still, you know, a competent person. There was a lot of range of female characters, but now in the new series, I'm seeing a much more constricted sort of range. They need to be enigmas like River Song or Clara, or they have to be kind of cartoonishly competent, again, like River. That's my postulation. I don't know.
And I have a theory of why that's happening. I think with this need to create all of these, you know, quote, strong female characters, you know, that are being demanded by the general populace now, writers don't quite know how to address
writer.
That.
Crazy.
I know. Yeah, female writers would do a lot.
Gloria Steinem.
Yeah. A female writer
I'm
would
burning
be
my bras.
They've been getting women.
They've been getting women directors.
Yeah. They have been getting some.
Yeah.
With some regularity. I mean, Rachel Talalay keeps showing up a lot.
And that helps.
I don't see why in all of England there is not more female writers to have on Doctor Who, considering the new series has so many female
viewers. Well, yeah,
viewers,
that's what I can't figure out.
That's bizarre.
That is not unique to Doctor Who. That is a problem that's endemic on pretty much all of television at the moment. And, you know, Hollywood, indeed, same thing. But, you know, with this drive to create better female characters and nobody really knowing how to deal with it because we're not hiring the right writers, apparently.
Well, there aren't any models in media for what, you say you want one, what is one? We've never had one.
Yeah, and so it's kind of corralling the writers into a certain sameness. So where there was a lot of, ironically, where there was a lot of freedom under the days of sexism, you know, we're kind of fenced in right now.
Well, this is a pretty big topic.
Yeah.
It is a huge topic.
Surface,
I think we've scratched the surface of it.
There needs to be an entire podcast just about this topic. I mean, like an ongoing podcast.
Should also not forget that a woman essentially created Doctor Who.
It's true.
Verity Lambert was...
Liar!
...as responsible as anyone for getting it off the ground in the first place.
So apparently this is the point in the episode where you randomly pick an episode. I said episode twice. Well, I'm your random number generator, and so I randomly, not really, picked Pyramids of Mars.
Yay, Pyramids of Mars.
I picked this because this, when I think of classic Doctor Who and like Tom Baker, this is the episode I always think of, and I specifically remember it because it's the first time I ever encountered in media the truth lie logic puzzle.
The Epimenides paradox.
Yes.
The Cretans. This Cretan always lies. This Cretan always tells
exactly.
the truth.
Yeah. It's the first time I had ever encountered it, and when I was a kid, I must have been like 8 or so, and I just thought that was the coolest thing ever. And so I'm like, oh, I want to do that episode. I remember that episode. And it just happened. I picked it because of that. And then I'm like, it's the Michael Sheard episode. Yay! There he is right now. Hi, Michael.
One of the many Michael
Sheards. One of the many Michael Sheards.
I'd be kind of freaked out if he were here right now.
Because the man's dead.
Yeah, the man is
dead. But it is an episode about, you know, mummies in ancient Egypt. So.
Oh, Wendy, you totally kissed a dead man.
I totally did kiss
did
a dead man.
Did you kiss Michael Sheard?
I did.
Tell our viewers how that happened.
Michael Sheard was a guest of honor at Convergence when I was still on the board, which gave me a little bit more heightened access to him, simply because we were all at opening and closing ceremonies together and various other things. And we invited him back two, three times?
I don't think it was quite that much, but yeah, he kept coming back.
He was such a delightful raconteur of a fellow that we invited him back. And one of those occasions, when he was on stage for closing ceremonies, he kissed every member of the board. So while I have kissed Michael Sheard, I want to point out that so has Christopher Jones and Tim Wick and Jeremy Stomberg.
Yeah, he was just kissing anybody he could get his hands on.
He really was. But it was still delightful. He was a very lovely man. Mm-hmm. To the point where when he died, we carried around an urn in his memory.
Yeah.
With a bow tie. An urn with a bow tie.
And wore a bow tie, yeah.
Yeah, the urn had its own convention badge.
It did?
Yes. It was decorated by people at the convention. It was very sweet.
It was fantastic.
It was very sweet of you.
Yeah. It did a badging station run. It volunteered to help run the convention. It was
And it was Michael Sheard that started the whole 5-day convention.
Yes.
Like chant thing.
Mm-hmm. He also is why we call it opening ceremony.
Yeah.
Because he had
an objection.
There is only one ceremony happening here, you stupid Americans, pluralizing the wrong words.
Oh, yeah, he was so charming. Very, very charming.
He's very charming in this.
Oh, he is.
Indeed.
He's very, very likable, very warm and relatable.
There's not a false note among the guest stars in Pyramids of Mars.
There really isn't.
I think it's...
Well, the first person you see is the father from Krull.
Yes.
It's true. It's Bernard Archer.
Or yeah.
I suppose his name would be Bernard.
Bernard.
Bernard Archer.
We're talking about Scarman, right?
Yes, Marcus and Lawrence Scarman.
Yeah, the
Scarman.
The cadaverous Scarman.
Yes.
Marcus. Because, you know, you just look at him and you're like, my God, this guy's straight out of Hammer Central Casting for... possessed old guy.
Much of this is out of Hammer Central Casting.
It is. It is basically just a Hammer story.
Well, yeah. I picked it, and it's like, oh, that's right. It's totally Egyptian, which is also one of my personal bugaboos. So it's like, yay, look, there's all Egyptian with Sutek, who is Set, and the mummies, the Rock'em Sock'em mummies, as I referred to them.
Well, and it's not just Egyptian. It's that turn of the century... love of everything Egyptian,
yes.
And that mysticism obsession that they had back then.
It does. I always do wonder why they set it in is 1900
or 1911.
1911, yeah. Which is about 10 years before the big Egyptian craze, because. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was in the 20s.
Yeah, 1920, I think, they opened the
tomb. Probably set it there because that's the dress they had for Sarah Jane or something. Ridiculous.
It really could have been.
Or
the sets were already set up for an episode of Upstairs, Downstairs.
Society 1911 it is.
Yeah. Or they didn't really want to deal with world wars at all.
I think that had to be a part of it, is that they just wanted a, you know, an olden time year that didn't have a big conflict inherent in it.
It's true. Psychologically, things are a lot different after the first war.
I'm just imagining, okay, we'll take a look at the timeline. What year did Britain not have a war? 1911 looks good. Okay.
That's it. Well, actually, just go with it.
So I'm glad you picked this one, because I think I'm speaking for all of us. This is one of our favorites, right? Or at least
for many years, I considered it my absolute favorite.
I love it up and
I had to.
Well, not up and down. The last episode's a little light, but I love it to death.
Having just watched it again yesterday, the top of episode 4 is about as good as Doctor Who ever gets, I think. It's after Tom has broken into the chamber, and it's just him and Sutek talking to one another for about 5 minutes or so. That is the
pinnacle, the apex of Doctor Who, as far as I'm concerned. Then it takes kind of a dive.
Here's how much I like this story. Way back in the olden days of the late 70s, when
I think you're using the wrong voice for that, Calvin.
Way back in the olden days, late 70s.
Thank you.
You know, when Mech was around.
Mech?
The Minnesota Educational Computer Consortium.
Of course.
It was like how to dial in.
We'll link to them.
They don't exist anymore, but it was an early educational thing where you could get on the computer and do like proto email and proto instant messaging on like green screen monitors.
Yep.
And stuff.
Was there a point?
Yes. The point was, being a 14-year-old kid at that time period and into Doctor Who, the name I picked for myself was Sutek.
Nice.
Bravo. I once convinced a local Doctor Who nerd to adopt a feral kitten I found in my garage by naming it Sutek.
Yes.
What's that person's name, Michael?
Michael Lee.
Michael Lee, Sutek the Destroyer, the little
orange
teeny
cat.
Little orange kitten. And his name is Sutek.
It was so adorable.
I have a slightly blue story that might have to get cut out.
Wait, why we don't go blue?
I have a friend, I won't name who it is, who suggested that he should name his penis Sutek, so he could say, kneel before the might of Sutek.
Yes, but can he do it in that voice? Because in
few
my
people
notes...
Can.
The irony is, if you can do it in that voice, you don't need to.
Right.
I wrote about this in my notes. The voicing of Sutek is delicious. It's very four E's. Evil.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He is great.
Oh, so
very early audiobooks of the Target novelizations are read by Gabriel Wolfe, who's great. But imagine he doesn't do any delineation between characters. It is just him. If it's Joe Grant, he's like, "What's going on, Doctor?" it is Sutek reading
it's
Target
Sutek
novelizations.
Reading you a story.
So, you know, he has this huge, long career as a voice artist. And much of these things are on, like, albums of poems that are out of print. Well, when I was in Rome, this is 15 years ago, and I went into the Keats-Shelley house by the Spanish Steps. It's where John Keats died. They have things for sale, including cassette tapes of the poetry of Byron, Keats, and Shelley, all read by Gabriel Wolfe.
Oh.
I picked up the Byron one, and I always regretted not getting the others because you can't find these online. They're not on CD. So anybody, any fans of ours in Rome, please mail me these cassettes.
Do right us now. A solid, and if you can take care of that.
But he's so great.
He has an amazing voice. I mean, it's just...
Well, and it's his cadence is what really actually sells it.
Yeah.
It's like he can't be bothered to speak any faster.
Yeah.
One of the things that I loved about this when I was a kid the first time I saw it, and I still really appreciate it on this recent viewing, is a lot of action with a sense of humor, and it's blended really well. And Doctor Who, even the classic series as well as the new series, has a hard time sometimes doing that. And it seems to be laced with a lot of humor that doesn't necessarily take the legs out from under the melodramatic stakes of the story.
Like
it's balanced really well.
When they're hiding in the trunk and he opens the lid and they pop up.
Yeah.
Oh, there's all sorts of little comic
and the duck
moments.
Walk.
There's a total like Scooby-Doo peek around the corner toward the end of one of the episodes where it's all of their heads, 1, 2, 3, piled on top of each other
as
they're peeking.
Isn't there a thing like when he and Sarah Jane are actually on Mars and they like step into the room and then just turn around and step back out?
Yes.
Because like it's just pure Marx Brothers. Just.
There's even some meta humor in here, which the classic series didn't do much. There's a reference to the historical inaccuracy of priest holes or something.
A priest hole in a Victorian Gothic folly? Nonsense. You're so pedantic.
Yes. Sarah basically says, can we just get on with the story?
It is a weird architectural element to put in a
well,
Victorian
Sarah
Gothic
is
folly.
Completely incorrect.
What's really great in this episode is how delightful Sarah is as she just teases the doctor. The doctor's kind of being grumpy, and she is just poking at him.
Well, we have a rare instance of a classic series emo doctor moment in the when we first see him, the camera zooms in, his hat is down, his head's down with his hat, and he lifts his face, and it's all the I'm a Time Lord, I walk in infinity, which we get a lot in the new series. But the companions just fall over themselves for this stuff. But Sarah Jane is in the background making faces and rolling her eyes while he's saying this stuff. I'm like, oh, for crying out loud.
Can we just get on with having some fun?
Yeah.
I did not sign up for this mystery.
I don't know how many times I've seen this, but I never noticed until this time somehow that she's wearing Victoria's old dress.
Well, he calls her Victoria at the beginning, too.
Yeah.
He says, hi, well... He says Vicky and then Victoria, like he can't keep his old companion straight.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And she has the great line when he says Victoria wore it, and she says, as long as Albert didn't wear it.
Right. Oh, the dialogue throughout is golden stuff. He's messing around with the canopic jar, is that the term?
Yeah.
He's like, oh, you got to be careful with this. It's like repairing a watch with a hammer and chisel. One false move and you'll never know the time again. It's just full of these wonderful lines.
Yeah, Sarah Jane is so delightful in this. I know that that the actress, like, at different points talks about how in later episodes, she's pretty much walking scenery. But she's on the top of her game in
so
this episode.
Funny. There's another great line, too, with... the explosive they find, she tosses it down to the doctor, and you do the wacky stuff like, this could explode at any second, even a sneeze could set it off, and then they can't find anything to set it off with. And she's like, well, maybe he just sneezed. There's just so much that's funny in here. And she's witty in the way a real person would
and
be
she
witty.
She shoots a gun.
Yes.
She's an eagle eye. She hits that thing.
She's a sharpshooter.
Dead on.
The Doctor, the Mummy, and sharpshooter Sarah Jane.
Mary Jane with a gun is in my happy space.
Yeah, I mean, that's really unusual when you look at the entirety of companion with guns like that.
At the edge of my knowledge, there's some other episode where she proves to be a good shot. It might be like Planet of Evil or something. But there is something about Sarah Jane's character there. This isn't the first time where she can fire a gun accurately.
Well, and I think the mummies are so hilarious. First off, the way they look. They really do look like Rock'em Sock'em mummies.
Like they have gigantic racks.
And they just sort of, you know, lumber. And then there's when the mummy gets caught in a bear trap. Who thought that was... I think that's hilarious. That's gold.
Well, when they kill the poacher by crushing him between their...
Yeah, they death by hug.
Yeah.
We're just going to hug you to death.
Obligatory poacher.
I remember that kind of bugging me at the time as a kid. Like, I don't get why the mummies are weird shaped.
I'm wondering if it was purely to justify the robot skeleton.
Oh, yeah.
That Tom can get into.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Eventually they unwind them and it's that.
Yeah, it's a little strange. But
I think it's an obvious visual cue of not human. You know, because if they had just, you know, wrapped up people like mummies, you just assume that the dead had come back to life, which would also be cool. But, you know, by making it very obvious that there's this weird chest cavity and the weird head thing.
And then there's, you know, Michael Sheard and his relationship with his brother. And he does something stupid, but then...
It's a really touching scene.
Yeah, but then he totally owns up to it and, like, begs forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And which...
He
actually has a little character arc in this. Yeah. For the classic series, that's
pretty rare, yeah.
Yeah, and the sad scene with it when he confronts his brother and ends up getting killed. But we have this moment where the doctor's kind of proved wrong because he's able to make some sort of contact with his brother who's still in there somewhere, even though he ends up getting killed.
And when they go to Mars.
Well, and why... Does Scarman have like a little baby radio telescope that he just built? I forget, like, why? Was it just he's just a hobbyist?
I think so.
It's Chekhov's radio telescope.
It's Chekhov's. You bring a radio telescope on stage, shoot it.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's just to get the idea of radio out there as a concept. So the Deus Ex Machina at the end, where they come back from Mars.
You know, and
they need the radio signal.
Right. They couldn't have just gone back in time a little bit. You know, that opens up all these.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know if steampunk is quite the right word to use for that, but that was like kind of one of my first exposures to old-timey technological stuff.
Yes,
And it's a Marconi.
By the way.
Yeah.
Marconi scope.
A Marconi scope, yes.
What hell?
You know, you're so
watching
pedantic.
This again, looking at it in the context of classic Doctor Who, it struck me as how very, very different these early Tom Baker ones were.
Especially, I mean, yeah, the later ones.
He is very cold and very alien compared to the previous three Doctors. Maybe William Hartnell at the beginning, but that doesn't really count because they didn't really even know what the hell they were going to do with the character of the Doctor. I think the comic side of Tom Baker has taken over and people forget how cold he was. A lot of people have compared Peter Capaldi to Colin Baker, but I mean, I think it's a closer approximation to this early Tom Baker. Yeah. We have the whole scene where he just pushes Sheard's body out of the way.
Yeah, cavalierly. He just...
Yeah. Ben, and he makes the same Mummy on the Orient Express point. He's kept track. He lists every person who's died in that moment when Sarah Jane calls him on it, and then says how many millions more people will die. So what is a tiny character moment in the classic series becomes a very emo full episode in the new series.
And it's unusual even for these early Tom Baker episodes. I can't think of comparable examples in Terror of the Zygons or Ark in Space. He's particularly cold here. And that's set off at the beginning with his little emo moments, the I Walk in Eternity.
Well, he does that thing in Ark in Space where he suddenly starts kind of insulting Sarah just as a way of spurring her on.
He can be cruel.
Yeah.
But the big touchstone of that episode is his Enconium to the human race, the indomitable, you know, which sets the whole tone of Ark in Space. But here, it's I'm a lonely god. The David Tennant-y kind of thing. Well, so, I mean, we could talk about, I personally could talk about this for the entire hour, but we probably only can go for a few more minutes on Pyramids of Mars. So whatever, I love it. This is one of my favorites. I could quote lines all day. I won't, because listeners could just go and watch it for themselves. But good, bad, what else? Big themes?
I love the special effects of the era. We're watching the video of the episode as we're recording this episode, and I'm watching the wonderful little chroma key effects that they're layering in there, and,
I love...
Cheap and delightful.
I love Sutek. I love that the villain is sitting still in a chair for almost the whole thing.
He's immobilized, so it's at least a narrative point.
But he's sitting there so threateningly, and I love his costume. I really love his costume.
And it's...
It's like early Trontastic.
Yeah.
I think is it the first time in Doctor Who where he's facing a threat this potentially enormous?
He says...
You know, like, nothing will stop Sutek if he gets free of this... imprisonment, you know, Kronos, even the Time Lords won't be able to stop.
Kronos was as bad in the Time Monster.
Yeah.
So there's a few.
And there's the
Omega.
The Doctor has to call the Time Lords. There are other times. But yeah, he's telling you pretty loud and clear, this is super, super scary right now. We've got to stop this guy.
And he does the odd time travel thing, too, where he takes Sarah back to 1980 and shows that the world has been destroyed.
That freaked me out as a kid.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's a great little
And it also led to the unit dating controversy. Because this wasn't 1980. This was 1976?
Six, seven.
Yeah. So there's this idea that, when did the unit stories take place? Did they take place in the present day or 5 years in the future or what? It led to some weird continuity stuff.
The whole traps and logic games are pretty lame. It's Sarah says it reminds me of the city of the Exelons, and you're like, yep, and that sucked too.
Oh yeah, the little visual puzzle that he's poking at.
It's really the only weakness in my mind to this entire story.
It had to be something like a kid could follow at home, I think. So they just use these.
That's a classic logic puzzle with the two buttons and the two robots. That's classic.
That's at least a little educational. It's just when they have, it's the earlier ones that are kind of silly.
Very weak.
It's weak and it feels like a lot of padding.
Yeah.
Whereas the other, it's directed with such energy throughout and tension, and it just sort of has a little lag there. Rarely is there a super exciting conclusion to a Doctor Who serial. It's the curse of serialization. Yeah. It's usually a little disappointing at the end. I forgive that. Mainly based on, this is my favorite line, I know you said you could quote lines all day and you wouldn't, but I'm not Pat and I will quote lines all day. This whole episode is worth the line, I shall mingle with the mummies, but I shan't linger.
Okay, next up on the podcast, we have Wonderful Afunctionalism. This is the segment when we just do some little creative thing that relates to Doctor Who in some way tangential or less so.
Your intro's going to be longer than the actual.
Probably will be, yes.
Keep going.
And today our guest, Wendy Bowlesby, has something she would like to share.
Yes, I wrote a haiku.
Oh my gosh.
Would you like to hear it?
Late
yes.
Yes.
The night full of stars. I look for one that's blinking with blue door open.
Oh. That's nice, yeah.
Come on, that's solid, yeah.
Yeah,
that's
solid.
Cool. Yeah, dig.
Dig that, man. Dig that.
So, it's the final round. It's the death zone. Today, our guest, Melissa, has got a Death Zone Coliseum match for us. What's it? What is it?
It is all of the Doctors in Curse of Fatal Death.
Yes.
Oh, God.
Yes. All five actors in Curse of Fatal Death that play the Doctor. We have Rowan Atkinson and Richard E. Grant.
Yes.
And Jim Broadbent.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Hugh Grant. And Joanna Lumley.
So before we start, recently at Console Room and at Convergence, we've done a number of these kind of matchups. So it might be good to figure out our parameters here. We've talked about, is this physical combat? Is this Joanna Lumley punching Hugh Grant in the teeth?
Oh, I would so want to see that. Oh, my God.
Because that's one approach. The other is, which do we prefer? Like, which doctor do we prefer? Do we prefer a Hugh Grant doctor over a Rowan Atkinson doctor?
I say
doctor?
We go with both. We just
Or like, who would make the better doctor?
Yeah,
like
if
that.
They proceeded on to a 13th doctor, which, you know, they'll find some way to do. You know, if we could pick one of the Curse of Fatal Death actors to take that role, who would we pick?
This sounds like the more fruitful approach.
Yes, because I think we'd all just want to see Joanna Lumley punch people in various parts of the
face. Yes!
If there were actual combat.
A super cut of Joanna Lumley punching people.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, so I'll start this discussion by just reminding people that when this was on the air, Doctor Who was not, and there was a serious case being made, as we've mentioned on the podcast before, that Rowan Atkinson was canonically the next Doctor.
Like, why are we even arguing about this? He should have been a Doctor.
That would be pretty awesome.
Do we think so?
I could picture Rowan Atkinson.
When he walked out, I was like, yes, this feels right. Yes, this is something I want.
You didn't think it was too self-parodic?
Well, I think that was part of what Curse of Fatal Death was. But I think if he...
Wait, it was supposed to be funny?
Oh.
You hurt me. You hurt me, Pat. But I think if he were genuinely cast as the Doctor, his portrayal would have been a bit different from what was shown
on
Curse.
He was limited by the script, but I think his performance could have transcended it.
Especially if he was acting like Mr. Bean.
Oh, come on.
But I was
some of what Patrick Troughton did was pretty damn goofy.
Yeah. I also want to mention Jonathan Pryce as the Master.
Jonathan Pryce is the Master.
Especially the whole...
Dalek bumps? Yeah.
The running gag of him constantly falling into the... giant sewer.
How
that
did
takes
I know?
Hundreds of years.
Oh, Kelvin, how did I know you'd pick that as a favorite moment?
And he comes out, he's like, oh, that took me 300 years. Ah! And he falls back into it. And finally, he's got the long beard and a walker. And he's like,
if Jonathan Pryce was the Master, I might give in. I have to say that.
Yeah,
I might be
much.
Like,
I don't care who the Doctor is if Jonathan Pryce
you
is the Master.
Go over to the dark side.
I totally would. For that voice, yes.
Oh, yes.
Oh, that voice. Now, that said, Richard E. Grant. Lick the mirror, gorgeous.
Well, here's a guy who actually did play the Doctor. Richard E. Grant.
Yes.
As the Doctor.
Scream of the Shalka.
The non-canonical ninth Doctor in Scream of the Shalka.
And he was pretty bad.
He was pretty bad.
He phones it in a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know,
one of the Matt Smith episodes, he also showed up as...
The Great Intelligence.
The Great Intelligence.
Once again,
not great.
Terribly impressive.
Not great, but you know, I feel like he wasn't given much to do.
I was just kind of waiting so other people could say things, but it's hands down for me, Jim Broadbent. I would love to see a super shy doctor who barely can step out of the TARDIS, who just turns around and walks back in. I would love that.
I love at least a season of that.
Don't you think he would be better as Jim Broadbent in Moulin Rouge? You know?
Yes, we can!
Because we can't get good! Oh my god, that would be amazing. I would love a totally new take on the doctor.
Soft spoken, shy doctor.
That would be hilarious.
Can't look the villain in the eye.
Like a little autistic, a little bit on the spectrum.
Rocking back and forth.
Like he still solves the problem, but it's almost like monk, a monk sort of doctor. Like he needs somebody to translate for him because he can't quite communicate with other people.
Yeah, if we were talking about changing the dynamic between the doctor and companions in the new series, that would be pretty awesome.
Well, and it would further Moffat's need to have a female so in control, right? Yeah. Well, there you go. Just go there.
Travel with his home nurse. It would be.
Can we all agree that Hugh Grant, though, should never be the doctor?
No, not for that at all.
Give a little love for Hugh because I actually like him in movies that I've seen, but I agree that he should not be the doctor.
No, I quite enjoy him.
He would be another stammery kind of.
He got overexposed right at that point in the
90s. Yeah, but we don't need another stammery sort of charm.
No. But I mean, come on, guys. It's got to be Joanna Lumley, right?
Yes!
It has to be Joanna
Lumley. Yes.
Because it has a vibrating set.
It has three settings.
Yes.
Not only does she have the acting ability to pull it off, but she's essentially played a Time Lord before in Sapphire and Steel.
Yes.
With David McCullough.
Yeah.
And although that was a weird, flat, affectless performance, and her doctor would inevitably be much more demonstrative than that, she can...
She's got comedy chops,
yes.
Right? I want that in a doctor. Not necessarily that I want a comedic doctor, but somebody who can be that funny is somebody who's going to bring a little bit more depth to how they portray things.
Yep. I love the bravado that she brings to the
role.
Just like, I've never driven one of these before, and, you know.
Yeah, she's just so big. Not like just tall, but just her personality is so... To use a word, if one were, we could have a cage match between her and Rowan Atkinson, and I would enjoy that.
That'd be kind of hot.
It would be hard to pull me away from Jim Broadbent, but one thing I really like about Joanna Lumley as the Doctor would be that she's an older woman.
Yes.
I guarantee if they do cast a female Doctor, they will not.
I feel like that's just such a mistake.
Woman.
I feel like it should be somebody older, more mature, somebody you're going to believe in an authority position.
Yeah.
We don't need the comedy of some young twee thing that everybody's like, "Oh, I can't believe you. You're just a girl." No, that's boring comedy. That's
I don't want an anime Doctor.
I want Helen Mirren or Tom Chapin.
I don't want a doctor wearing a pink
uniform. Helen Mirren would be fantastic. Yeah. Or Maggie Smith.
Maggie Smith, yes.
If you're going to have Capaldi, I feel like Maggie Smith is the next step. Or you could get both Rowan Atkinson and Joanna Lumley. Why can't the doctor travel with one of his own past or future incarnations?
Can he regenerate into a Siamese twin? Can he?
Could he regenerate into two people? Yeah, exactly.
Wouldn't it be fun? Because they keep doing it with like the five doctors and all the doctors together. It's like, wouldn't it be fun to just have the doctor be like, "You, let's travel together. You're annoying." and just constantly be sparring but truly be equals. That would be super great.
So we're saying it's a tie?
Yes.
Rowan Atkinson and Joanna Lumley? No, I'm team Joanna here.
Joanna.
If there's a tie, it's Joanna Lumley and Broadbent. Who can't look at her at all.
That would be the best. You're right.
He keeps knocking himself out unconscious as he looks away.
What do you think, Kelvin? You've been quiet.
Yeah. Either Joanna Lumley or Rowan Atkinson, I could see being the doctor.
Well, Joanna Lumley has enough votes to win.
We won't
consider who the secondary man doctor is.
So what kind of companion should she have? Do we think she should just have
Edina from Absolutely Fabulous as her traveling
or
companion.
Or bring back Donna Noble.
Oh my God. That would be epic.
Oh, those two ladies on screen. Oh
my God.
Yeah.
What I would want is somebody like Donna.
Don French.
Like, not being subservient, not being pushy, but like what I love is Joanna Lumley in that same dynamic that the Doctor and Donna had with her companion, where they're just chums and let's just go have fun together. Mm-hmm. That would be super enjoyable. So yeah, a lot like Ab Fab, only without the alcohol.
If you insist, yeah.
Why not?
It wouldn't be some young, handsome guy with hair hanging over one eye and his shirt half unbuttoned.
He'd show up for an episode or two.
Don't you think it should be more like Baldrick from Blackadder?
I have a cunning plan.
It would be fun to have it be an older fellow like Donna's father. For a while there, I was really hoping that Donna's father was going to be a companion. I would have really enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm. I'm with you. I like the older companions in general, and it's one thing that the TV show has not really done very well, that the audios have occasionally done better. We had Evelyn in the audios, who was an older woman.
Yeah.
And I would love to see that represented more on film. I think
no
Joanna.
No one under 45 on Doctor Who, damn it.
How old are you now, Josh?
43.
And that's our show. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and thank you to our guests, Wendy and Melissa. But we will not say goodbye to them because they are going to be in our next episode. These ladies are staying the night.
Bow chicka what?
Yeah.
Can we share the couch?
It'll be fine, ladies.
Don't worry.
Bow chicka woo.
Don't worry. So join us next time when we will be discussing Shada.
Oh my God.
In the death zone, we will be pitting Riversong and Clara. Until then, I'm Joshua.
I'm Kelvin.
I'm Melissa.
I'm Wendy.
I'm Pat. And we're saying,
get off my world!
I think Kelvin should introduce Wendy.
I probably should, yeah.
You probably should. Introduce yourself to Wendy.
Go ahead, I'll be your wingman. Wait, what are we talking about?
This got weird. That's awkward. Don't do that.
I'm gonna go.